Please stand with me for the reading of the word. Proverbs 31, 8 to 9. Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. The word of God. You may be seated. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your story. I was so impressed by the interview, and there was a moment that stuck with me from Chris's story, and that was that moment on the school bus where a bully is saying bad names and bad words, and the most popular girl in school says, "Hey, leave Chris alone. That's not who he is." We all need someone to speak up for us, don't we? As I was hearing his story, I knew the scripture talks about speaking up for people, and we were sitting around the table with the pastoral team, and these two verses from Proverbs 31 came up. And I thought, I have never seen these two verses in Proverbs 31 before. Oh, I'm sure I've read them, but for me, Proverbs 31 has always been about the Proverbs 31 woman. And I don't know how I feel about this woman. I mean, on the one hand, she is a liberated woman, is she not? She's an entrepreneur. She has her own clothing line. She goes to the gym. Don't believe me? It says she makes her arms strong. She has her own nonprofit, helping the poor and the needy. She is a liberated woman. But on the other hand, she's superhuman. She gets up in the dark to get the food ready and write the delegation list for everyone else in the household. And the text says her lamp does not go out at night. So as it said, she's burning the candle at both ends. I want to say to her, "Sister, you don't have to do it all." So I have to say, I've been rather distracted by the Proverbs 31 women, and I haven't noticed how this whole chapter starts. The chapter starts with a proverb from another woman that I don't know anything about. She's the mother of a king, King Lemuel. Now, scholars disagree on who this king is. Some people say this is King Solomon and this is Bathsheba writing these words to him, but we don't really know. We just know it's a queen mother and she's writing to her son. And these first verses go to her son, and she starts by telling her son what she does not want him to do. Verse 3, "Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings." Verse 4, "It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink." Now, avoiding sex and alcohol is hardly new advice. This mother wants to make sure her son stays in the straight and narrow. Be careful about the women. Be careful about the drugs and alcohol. This was the favorite topic of some of my teachers and pastors in high school. I kept feeling like, we've got the message. Can you move on to something else? But this mom wants her son to stay away from women, stay away from alcohol. But the surprise in the text comes from her rationale and the alternative she recommends for him. Why? Why stay away? Verse 5, "Lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted." The queen mother knew that drinking gets in the way of justice. Now, for those who have lived through the trauma of domestic abuse from a partner or a parent addicted to alcohol, or for those who have lost a loved one to a drunk driver, this lack of justice is not hard to imagine. But surely these are extreme cases, one may protest. Well, let's pause a moment on this question. This January, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory calling for health warning labels on alcohol to include risks of certain cancers. After tobacco and obesity, alcohol consumption, they said, is the third leading preventable cause of cancer in the United States, contributing to 20,000 cancer deaths each year. Even one drink a day can raise your cancer risk. They're recommending lowering the limits to one drink a week to avoid cancer, increasing your cancer risk. Well, but you might say, well, okay, you haven't convinced me, Pastor, about this alcohol thing. And how does that have to do with justice? Perhaps it's just harming me. If it harms me, it's my choice. What does that have to do with justice? Since the 1950s, researchers have studied why people drink. In a study from the early 1990s of Michigan residents who had consumed alcohol in the last 30 days, they worked with two main reasons. And here they are. Number one, to cope with stress. Number two, to be sociable. People said on the survey, I just want to forget my troubles, I just want to relax, or I just want to be with other people, and this is something fun we do together, and we celebrate. Interestingly, in this study, Black participants drank less alcohol than white participants. They rated drinking to cope with stress higher, while white participants rated social drinking higher. Now, what does this have to do with justice? When you drink to cope, you forget your own discomfort, but it also makes you forget the discomfort of others. When you drink to socialize, it's easy to forget the ones who were not at that table. When the Seventh-day Adventist Church was organized in 1863, many Adventists were already part of the temperance movement, a social and political campaign to reduce or eliminate alcohol consumption. That's the definition on Wikipedia, the temperance movement. In 1880, Edson White published a book called Temperance and Gospel Songs. And here is an example. I recognize Dare to Be a Daniel, but other than that, there was one other song that I recognized from my childhood, Chewing in the Parlor. Did any of you learn this song? Was it only me in Berrien Springs, Michigan? Chewing in the Parlor. There's a line that says that I'll always remember, maidens never marry men who smoke or chew. If you chew tobacco, you will never do. This is my childhood. Smoking and chewing song in Edson White's temperance book. There's another song in there that I wanted to point out. I did not know this song before. It's called The Drunkard's Greeting. And I'm going to read you the fourth verse out of five verses. Okay, the fourth verse says, He promised I should courage have for all the ills of life. The bravest thing he made me do was beat my little wife. He promised he would give me wit that I should ne'er be sad, instead of which he took away what little sense I had. Can you imagine being in a meeting together and singing these songs? They're pretty uncomfortable. The founders of this movement were very concerned and serious about the impacts of alcohol, tobacco, not only for one's personal health, but the health of the community. The justice for the community. Now, what about those of us who don't drink alcohol? We decided not to, we resolved that, we're committed to that. Are we immune to allowing stress and social pressures to prevent us from speaking up? Early Adventists identified our mission with three angels from the book of Revelation. Three angels from the book of Revelation, and the middle angel, Revelation 14, verse 8, said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her prostitution." I also memorized this in fourth grade. There was a song. I won't sing it for you, though. Again, a warning against sex and alcohol. And maybe some of you recognize this picture of the woman with the beast and the wine cup. But this time, these were symbols of something else. Babylon represents political and religious power that works together to perpetuate injustice. This intoxication with power makes us choose what's comfortable. Why do we drink? We drink to release stress, right, to cope. Choose what's powerful instead of addressing suffering. It makes us choose what's socially acceptable instead of what's just. And you know, when we drink Babylon's wine, we drink Babylon's wine when we're just trying to cope with our lives and we don't want to rock the boat. In the text, when Babylon falls in Revelation chapter 18, the merchants weep because no one buys their cargo anymore. And what's at the end of a long list of previously profitable items? Verse 13 of chapter 18. Cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, choice, flour, and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses, chariots, slaves, and human lives. Early Adventists didn't just speak out against the effects of alcohol. They spoke out against the intoxicating effects of political and religious power. John Byington, the first president of the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, he left the Methodist Episcopal Church because it didn't take a stand against slavery. At his farm in New York, this was the first General Conference president of this Seventh-day Adventist denomination that this church is part of. The very first General Conference president, guess what? In his farm in New York, he had a station of the Underground Railroad illegally transporting people enslaved from the South to Canada. In 1850, President Fillmore signed a second Fugitive Slave Act into law. It threatened fines and imprisonment to anyone who helped runaway slaves. Fines and imprisonment. One of our founders, Ellen White, wrote this: "When the laws of men conflict with the word and law of God, we are to obey the latter, whatever the consequences may be." Fines, imprisonment. We will not obey this fugitive slave law, Ellen White says. In 1891, Edson White, the same son who published the temperance songs, began evangelistic and educational work for the Southern Black community from a boat on the Mississippi called the Morning Star. And he collected some words that his mother had written about this work. And this is one of those quotes. "The American nation owes a debt of love to the colored race, and God has ordained," remember this is from 1901, "God has ordained that they should make restitution for the wrong they have done them in the past. Those who have taken no active part in enforcing slavery upon the colored people are not relieved from the responsibility of making special efforts to remove as far as possible the sure result of their enslavement." So what does the Queen Mother want her son to do instead of drinking? Proverbs 31:8-9 that we read at the beginning today, "Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. In the Greek, this is literally, open your mouth, open your mouth. But I have to admit to you, it's easier for me to keep my mouth shut. Have you had a moment where you regretted keeping your mouth shut? I'm working on this sermon this very week, and I had a moment. I met someone for the very first time, and they made a disparaging remark about someone else that was not present, that was from another nationality, and they implied that this was because of that person's nationality. And I froze. I didn't say anything. And I regret that. I keep running it through my head and thinking, what would the right thing to have said in that moment? How should I have opened my mouth? I don't want to have more moments of regretting opening my mouth and not sticking up for the people that are being bullied, even if they're not there, perhaps especially if they're not there. That's a way that people are silenced, because they're not there to speak up for themselves as well. I don't want to have more moments like that. When I was working on the book In Grandpa's Shoes, my grandfather, I love him so much. I'm so proud of him. He's done so many things that I followed in his footsteps. But I also wanted him to share, what are those moments of regret for you? What do you wish you had done differently looking back? And one of those moments he shared about was in the 1970s when he was the head of the theology department at Helderberg College in South Africa, at which time apartheid was the law of the land. A white South African evangelical guest lecturer asked him if he knew that three of his students, all taking theology, all people of color, were not allowed to eat in the cafeteria. They would come each day by train. Another student would come and pick them up and take them onto campus. And there were students that they made friends with that they would hang out in their rooms, but they were not allowed to eat in the cafeteria. So my grandfather heard that comment, and he remembered hearing that comment, but he accepted it as just the way things were. And he told me when we were working on this book, he said, I wished I had spoken up after that conversation. I wish I had said something. So before the book was published, I asked people to read it and give feedback. And one of my readers was Pastor Ron Dupree. Pastor Ron, I chose him because he's from South Africa, he's a pastor, and he's also an ultra marathon runner. He's 73 now. I saw him recently, I ran a 10K recently, and that's Pastor Ron. He's the pastor of the Beaumont Church now, 73. He told me that this last Sunday he got up and decided to run a half marathon without training for it specifically. And he ran it in 1 hour and 45 minutes and won his age category. That's a little bit about who this guy is. This spring, he's planning to walk 50 kilometers a day for 50 days in 50 different states to raise awareness about seniors exercising and to raise $50,000 for a new community center for his church in Beaumont. Do you know how much 50 kilometers is? It's about 32 miles. This is a remarkable gentleman that I have so much respect for. He read my book and he called me and said, I have to tell you something. I'm one of those three students that they wouldn't allow to eat in the cafeteria. He told me more of the story. His dad, Elwin Dupree, had been the first person of color accepted at Helderberg in 1967, 1968. But when graduation time came, he was not allowed to march. He had to accept his certificate at a school about 15 miles away that was a black school. He was not allowed to graduate and walk up to the front because there were some faculty members who said, if you let him march, we will boycott the event. His cousin, so his brother, he has a two-year older brother, and Elwin, this is Pastor Ron's father, Elwin was very upset. I would be too. been doing all the work, ready to graduate, not allowed to graduate. And his older brother, 2 years older, he said, "Elwin, be patient. Justice will prevail." In 2007, 33 years later, my ultra runner friend, Pastor Ron, that's him there, he was the first person of color to be honored as Alumnus of the Year at Helderberg. And his cousin, Gerald, the son of that brother who told his dad to be patient, was the first person of color to be the college president. And that same weekend, his dad was invited to come and march down the aisle to accept his diploma 39 years later. All on the same weekend. Perhaps you have a family story of opening your mouth for justice. I'm proud that my uncle, Dr. John Webster, our first preacher in this series, was part of crafting the Seventh-day Adventist Church's statement of confession to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission led by Desmond Tutu. This week I heard a story about Dr. Adeni Schmidt, part of the Sutter family over this part of the church, who came to the United States from Argentina as a 17-year-old in 1964. She was one of my professors when I was in college. She's there on the right, and I think she still looks like herself. She remembers one of the few times her dad decided to turn on the television on a Sabbath. They had just gotten there, they were living in Washington, D.C., and there was a march happening that day, possibly the March on Washington to end the war in Vietnam. "Don't stand by while human life is destroyed," was the statement on one of the flyers. Adeni's dad suggested that they join the march. It was such an important cultural moment that they needed to witness it. It was Sabbath, and they needed to open their mouths. I heard a story from Kevin Strain, one of our worship leaders here today. His stepfather was a student at Oakwood College in Huntsville, Alabama. In the early 1960s, students at this historically black Adventist school had been told not to engage in these marches. His stepdad, Russell Nelson, did so anyway. You can see him there. He held a banner that said, "We shall overcome." And guess what? Today, his picture holding that banner is displayed in a hall at Oakwood, celebrating the struggle. I read a story this week from that same book, from that same time, 1965, from the Seventh-day Adventists and the Civil Rights Movement, by Samuel London. He tells a story of how in 1965, two Oakwood faculty members decided to attend the Huntsville Central Seventh-day Adventist Church. The head deacon tried to stop them from entering, but the women were insistent. They went down and sat down, but the preacher stopped his sermon, told them the church was not integrated, and asked them to leave. So the next week, a group of Oakwood students tried to enter the same church. A deacon met them at the door with a gun and used a racial slur, told them to leave. So one of the Oakwood faculty members, Dr. Alfonso Green the Senior, felt he must do something. He brought more students to the church, but that time the church leaders decided to shut down the whole worship service and have everybody go home. The next week, Oakwood's president held an emergency meeting of faculty and staff and ordered them not to go to the church. I'm guessing they were getting some pressure from a few different places. Dr. Green said, "As an adult, I can go anywhere I'd like to go, thank you very much," but he promised that he would not take the students. So he said, "Fine, I will not take students with me." So he told the students on Sabbath morning that he couldn't take them, and the students said, "We'll meet you over there." Okay. When the group entered the foyer that day, the Adventist minister promised to resolve the problem if they agreed to leave. And that week, the members of the Huntsville Central Seventh-day Adventist Church voted to allow all people into their sanctuary to worship. The grandson of that courageous professor is the lead pastor of our sister church, Mount Rubidoux, Pastor Alfonso Green III. And here he is with his dad, his grandfather, and his son, four generations. What stories would you like to tell? What stories would you like your grandchildren to be able to tell about you opening your mouth for justice? In Proverbs 31, the queen tells her son, "Look, if anyone needs alcohol, it's those afflicted ones. Leave it to them. verses 6 and 7, give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. But when Jesus was in misery, he didn't take the wine. Mark 15, verse 23, it says, and they offered him wine mixed with myrrh to help ease his suffering, and he did not take it. Earlier in his ministry, he had not been afraid to open his mouth. In Matthew 23, verse 13, he said, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you lock people out of the kingdom of heaven, for you do not go in yourselves, and when others are going in, you stop them. But on the day of his execution, King Jesus chose to be like the one who was silenced. Matthew 27, verse 14, but he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor Pilate was greatly amazed. Jesus stands in solidarity with all those who have been silenced. Jesus insists on feeling our pain down to the very last drop. Last week, Dr. Holowiak Valentine shared this hymn of Paul's from his Dark Night of the Soul, and I'm going to jump into it on verse 8. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him even more highly and gave him the name that is above every other name, so that at the name given to Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Babylon is not Lord. Caesar is not Lord. And on that day, every silenced tongue will be free to say, Jesus Christ is Lord. Until that day, let's follow the wise words of King Lemuel's mother. And this is my translation. Open your mouth for the silenced, for all the left behind children. Open your mouth, judge righteously. Use your privilege for those who have been beaten down and don't have what they need. Amen.